MacCast, Thursday, May 29th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, we got a ginormous show for you today. Actually, lots of stuff to talk about. Lots of stuff has been going on in the Apple and Mac worlds. A lot of it surrounding what's going to be happening next week at the Worldwide Developers Conference, WWDC. We've got a lot of rumors surrounding that. But then some new news on the Beats front. So we're going to talk about some iWatch rumors, some of the latest products, what we're going to be seeing at WWDC, the big Beats announcement from Apple, and also dispelling some of the rumors about iMacs and things like that, and a little bit of a security thing going on this week as well with some folks in Australia. So we're going to talk about that and a whole lot more in the news. And then we're going to get to a lot of your feedback. I got some great feedback on some of the last few episodes surrounding things like my naming for OS 10, 10.10, the triple 10 or 10 cubed, as I'm calling it. Also got some feedback on the iTunes album art issues and a little trick there, as well as a tip and trick again on older support for printers in Mac OS X. So we have all of that, and I have a story of woe for you about some issues I had with my MacBook Pro, actually a failed logic board to fill you in on, and some more stuff surrounding iTunes 10.11.2 and updates, and we'll be finishing off talking about Thunderbolt docking solutions. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Rage Software. They make a great application called Everweb. Something I get asked about still to this day constantly is, hey, I used to have an iWeb website, and I loved iWeb. I loved what Apple was doing with it, especially the whole hosting part of it. It was seamless, easy to do. I need a solution for that. What would you recommend? Well, it was really hard up until Rage came out with Everweb, because there wasn't really a one-for-one sort of comparable solution, and Rage set out and they built Everweb, and it is awesome. It brings back that whole iWeb experience in terms of the ease of use and functionality, but takes it to the next level. It modernizes it. So they bring it up to date, get you all the support for things like HTML5, including HTML5 audio and video, but with that ease of use that you have with iWeb. So you have drag and drop website creation using great pre-built templates that then you can fully customize. They support things like master pages, so you can get your navigation and your footers all in one place and make those easy to update. They have a ton of really great widgets that you can throw in there. So if you need a Google map or a contact form, also social media integration with Facebook and Twitter and Google, all of that stuff is included in the package and you can drop it in. And like I said, more modern enhancements and updates. So things like Google fonts, so you can have just the right font in your website, or SEO tools for search engine optimization. And they have great mobile templates included with every design. So your site can be responsive and mobile ready, look great on iOS devices and smartphones and things like that. And they give you the option to buy the standalone app, so you can buy that and upload via FTP using your own hosting, or they also have the Everweb with Hosting Edition, which gives you that easy one-click publishing. So you build your site in Everweb, you click one button, it publishes it right up, just again like that whole iWeb experience. And best of all, MacCast listeners, you can get 15% off Everweb by using the code MACCAST at checkout. They also have a 60-day money-back guarantee and a free trial version, so you can try it all out, no risk, and I think you're really going to like it, especially if you've been looking for that replacement for iWeb. So check it out. Everwebapp.com is the website, and a big thank you to Rage Software for their support of the MacCast. Let's kick things off today talking a little bit about the iWatch, Apple's rumored wearable device. Analyst Brian Blair of Rosenblatt Securities claims to have caught a glimpse of the iWatch while he was walking around Apple's supply chain in Taiwan, and he claims something that I really hope is true in terms of the design, and that is that it will have a round face that Apple won't go with the squarish version. I know some people are pretty excited about the band style version. There have been a couple versions where it sort of had this wrapped display. It doesn't sound like that's going to be happening. I think that's a little further out in terms of the technology needed to actually make that happen. You know, Apple's pretty good at putting stuff together, but I don't think they're quite there yet. But this would be said to look similar to the designs we've seen for the Moto 360, but actually have a slimmer profile. So it's going to be a little bit thinner. But I think that is a great way to go with a watch design. The square faces are good in terms of screens, but I think they're just a little bit too large. And most people, when you think of a watch, you think of that sort of round design. Brian Blair is saying that they are going to start production sometime this summer, so that would fall in line with some sort of fall launch, and that Apple would be looking to build between 18 million and 21 million units before the end of 2014. Another thing that's coming out in this rumor that I think is really important is that the watch will potentially come in two sizes so that they can market a version to men and women. I think stylistically, that's a really good move if Apple can actually pull it off. I would question on a smaller size device with a round screen how the functionality and utility works, but that's more of a UI software and design kind of thing. And I think Apple could sort of solve that problem. I'm sure they've been thinking a lot about it. Something that isn't mentioned in the report, however, is all of the different health aspects of Apple's device. They don't go beyond just kind of the watch form factor, and it's really expected to be loaded with a bunch of sensors and things like that that would tie into a companion app called HealthBook that's expected to come out in iOS 8. And you look at all of the recent acquisitions Apple has made in those fields, in health and fitness, in sensor technology, and in fashion especially, and this form factor and design, I think, really speaks to that a lot. But there's going to be a lot of high technology in there as well. And I think that's one of the things that most interests me about the iWatch, is that it's not just another smartwatch like we're seeing come out on the market right now. And a lot of the reviews of stuff that is out, I just saw some early reviews of the new LG watch, or you look at what Samsung's offering is, a lot of them just say, you know, it's really just notifications on your wrist. And I have a Pebble, and with the latest software, the Pebble has gotten a lot better and more useful, but it still doesn't do much more than the phone in my pocket can do. And I think Apple's really thinking beyond that. Another rumor we heard this week out of China was that Apple is testing charging coils to do wireless charging in the iWatch. And I think that makes a lot of sense, too. You want a convenient way to charge it without having to plug it in. A lot of the watches that are out on the market, smartwatches out on the market right now, they use like a magnetic system, almost like a MagSafe connector. That's what my Pebble uses. And it doesn't stick very well. It's kind of inconvenient to have the cable and things like that lying around. You got to plug it into a wall charger. With wireless charging, you could just set up different chargers in different areas, and especially on your nightstand at night, it would make sense that you go to bed, you take the watch off, you just set it on the little charger, and away it goes. Apple has reportedly been struggling, though, with the battery life in the iWatch, getting maybe 1 to 2 days out of it, according to reports, and they really want to target 4 to 5 days of battery life in normal usage. And I think that's a really good target to try and hit. As far as when we will see an iWatch, most still believe that we will have an announcement sometime in the fall, and everything seems to be lining up for that. As I was prepping the show this week, there were a number of items talking about the rumor and speculation surrounding the whole Apple Beats deal. There was a lot of going back and forth on whether or not the deal was going to happen, what kind of parameters might be changing. Well, Apple made it official this week. They did buy out Beats, or are going to buy out Beats, for $3 billion, a little bit under the 3.2. Actually, when you break it down, it turns out to be $2.6 billion for the purchase price, and then another $400 million that will vest over time. Of course, the whole deal is subject to regulatory approvals, and the transaction is actually expected to close sometime in Apple's fiscal fourth quarter. I wouldn't expect that there would be any regulatory issues with the deal going through, and I haven't seen any reports, or no one seems to be claiming that it's going to be a problem for Apple to actually buy Beats. The co-founders of Beats, Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre, will both be joining Apple. They are going to be reporting directly to Vice President Eddie Q. He's in charge of internet and services at Apple, so iCloud and iTunes, the App Store, all that sort of stuff. Iovine is going to leave his current job as chairman of Vivendi Interscope Records, and he will be working full-time for Apple. Dr. Dre is going to continue to produce music and will also be working at Apple at the same time. I guess they're both going to be in Cupertino supposedly as often as needed. And then the Beats Electronics, that's the headphone part of Beats, will fall under Phil Schiller's leadership. So all the Beats music stuff is falling under Eddie Q, and Beats Electronics headphones will be supervised by Phil Schiller and his team. Most people have a feeling that Iovine and Dr. Dre are going to help Apple out a lot in negotiations and dealing with Hollywood and the music industry. Iovine especially has really deep ties and is known best for being able to get deals done. He has helped Apple in the past, and Eddie Q has been trying to get all those deals done, but I think he's hit some resistance, and it makes sense to have a heavy hitter in the music industry, somebody like Iovine, on Apple's staff. Also, Dr. Dre helping out in that capacity as well, of course. But those guys having those kinds of inner industry connections and things like that should really help Apple be able to push their music offerings forward. And as far as what those music offerings look like, we saw or got some insight from some comments that Eddie Q made at the Code conference, which is now what the D conference used to be. That's the one with Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher, and it's put on by now the Recode site, which is the new site they started up after leaving D, All Things Digital. And so they had Iovine and Eddie Q there, and they were asking him about the deal, and Eddie said he really expects it to improve Apple's music lineup, and he talked about the three services that Apple has almost as separate things. So he talked about free iTunes Radio being one thing, the world-class Beats music subscription service, and people buying music in iTunes, all of those things being helped out by having Iovine and Dr. Dre on staff. And that means that Apple is planning to keep Beats Music as a separate brand, at least for now. And they also announced they will be keeping around the Windows Phone and the Android versions of the Beats Music app. So it definitely seems like part of the whole rationale for Apple buying Beats and Beats Music was to keep that service going and to move into a streaming music service. But it doesn't sound like that's going to be in lieu of what they're doing with iTunes Radio or the iTunes Store. So they're not going all in with one or the other. Some had speculated that iTunes Radio could be combined with Beats Music or kind of go away, and Apple just offering a streaming music offering. But it sounds like they're going to play in all three fields. And Q's comments are actually in line with a TechCrunch report that said that Apple really wants an easy transition for the music industry. You would think maybe for customers, or they would want a lineup that customers could kind of find the service that fit with them. But really, what they're implying is that they're looking at the music industry and they're looking at artists, and they want to protect those artists in the music industry from what's happening with streaming services, which is the revenue shift. There's a whole revenue shift, and there's going to be a transition going on. iTunes sales actually account for $1 billion, or about 63% of music industry revenues from direct sales of songs and albums. That's in 2013. So direct sales and songs in iTunes sold to consumers accounted for 63% of the industry's revenues. So if all of that just suddenly shifted over to a streaming music service, it could potentially crater all of that revenue if everybody migrated at once. So iTunes Store sales are declining. We saw a couple of reports about that this week, and consumers are moving toward other options like streaming radio or radio and streaming services and things like that. But iTunes still has 800 million account holders compared to something like Beats Music, some had speculated had paid subscribers in the 110,000 range. During that interview, I think they said Beats has 250,000 paid subscribers, but still a drop in the bucket compared to the number of iTunes account holders that Apple has. So they need to start transitioning those accounts to the different kinds of services. And Apple's saying Beats Music is going to let them transition customers and the industry gradually, and I think really it gives Apple an advantage because they get to play all sides of the field, right? They get to sell music to those people who want to own music. They get to have a really top-notch music subscription service, even if it hasn't taken off in terms of subscriber base. You talk to anybody about the quality of the service and the app and the quality of, say, like the curated playlists that are done by artists and a team of supposedly really smart professionals at Beats, most people don't dispute it's a really, really good service. And I'm actually kind of interested to maybe start trying it out. I hadn't really thought about it before, and maybe it's the Apple fanboy in me. I can kind of admit that, but I'm now interested at kind of taking a look at it and seeing how it goes. Apple, you know, is showing really it's not an all or nothing game. Each service can exist and sort of feed one another. And I think they'll do that moving forward. I think it's really just a shift, like a lot of things. It's, you don't have an all-in-one shift, say, from books to ebooks, or from, you know, buying movies and DVDs straight into digital stuff. There's a gradual transition, and people kind of focus their energy in different places. And I think Apple wants to be in all those markets. It's just how big each one of those things is going to get shifted around a little bit. And Apple's seeing that, and I think they're really planning for the future. So I'm starting to see in this deal, this was a lot of Apple forward thinking and kind of looking at, okay, where's our business now? Where are things moving, and where do we want to be down the road? They didn't talk too much about that headphone business. And so it's not clear what Apple's plans for Beats and headphones is, whether they'll roll it in. It looks like at least they're rolling in the design. Beats has actually captured about 60%, I guess, of the headphone market. I couldn't really tell, maybe just the high-end headphone market. But basically, they make over $1 billion in sales, which is not chump change. You know, in Apple's ecosystem, it's not a ton, but that's about the same as the Apple TV. So it's a significant piece of business. And the brand itself is super strong, despite what you might think about the quality. There's some questions about how high-end or how quality the headphones are when you ask different people. But there's no doubt that it's hugely popular with artists and celebrities and athletes. So it has a really high profile, and that trickles down to consumers. A lot of consumers are all about the brand, and having another strong brand in Apple's portfolio, I think, is ultimately a good thing. They did say, like I said, the design is transitioning from Beats outside design team ammunition over to Apple. I guess that's already been in the works. But that business is going to keep going. It'll be interesting to see if they keep it as a wholly separate brand. I'm thinking that they might, and just sort of run by Apple, but we don't really know at this point. A lot of people have really questioned the cost of the whole acquisition, and a number of people are asking the question, well, why did Apple pay so much to buy Beats when they really could have just built a streaming service? They could have built these problems or these kinds of products themselves. And Tim Cook responded to that in a Recode interview, in essence saying, look, this gives Apple a head start, and we also gain a bunch of incredible people that are already kind of making this stuff. They've been doing it. They're some of the best in their field and making these kinds of products. So Apple would have to go out and find those people. There's a long process involved in that. And I think more importantly, what he pointed out is that culturally, the two companies are very much in sync. They kind of have the same design to art philosophy, right? Or technology to art philosophy. As Steve Jobs used to put it, they're at that intersection of art and technology, and they kind of bring those things together. So there's a lot of focus on design and functionality and the technology and stuff like that combined. So it does seem like when you look at all the other companies that are doing stuff like this out there, it does seem kind of like a good fit for Apple's culture. So on a lot of levels, it kind of starts to make sense when you really start to break it down like this. And, you know, the other big thing is a lot of people are now saying this really could be a disruption to the whole music industry, with Apple having Beats and the kind of people that the company comes with on board. And we know that that's something that Apple likes to do, to kind of shake up an industry. We're already seeing the ripples of that, right? The starting of that. The wave is beginning because a lot of people are talking about this. And it's over the past couple of weeks, it's got a lot of excitement and a lot of buzz behind it. A lot of people are wondering and curious now about what Apple is doing, what Beats is doing, both in the music and now the television space, and we're hearing all kinds of sorts of things. So this is the kind of place that Apple likes to be in moving forward. And then following the announcement, Beats Music did make a few changes that make it pretty attractive for those of us who might want to look into the service. First of all, they extended the trial period. They doubled the trial period for the service from 7 days to 14 days because it is a paid subscription service. After those 14 days, if you don't sign up, then you lose access to the subscription. But they also dropped the price of the annual subscription. It's now US $99.99, so about $100, down from $119.88 a year, which about $120, right? So I'm curious to try it out, and I might give it a look. If you've used Beats or Beats Music and you've played around with the subscription service and you want to give us your opinion, that would be awesome. Send us a little audio comment, a little audio review. If you tried it out and didn't like it, we'd like to hear that. I'm kind of curious to hear what the general consensus in the Apple community is about Beats Music and how it might fit in with Apple. So if you'd like to chime in on any of that, shoot us an email, mattcast@gmail.com. Let's talk a little bit about WWDC and what might be coming. Usually WWDC is a software-focused conference, but this year we've been hearing a lot about a possible hardware announcement. Nobody really knows exactly what that hardware announcement might be. There's a lot of speculation one way or the other. Some people think it might be an iWatch. Some people think it might be an Apple TV thing. KGI analysts Ming-Chi Kuo, who typically I put a little trust in kind of some of his rumors, he was thinking that Apple might be announcing a less expensive iMac along with a new lower-priced iPhone 5S model at WWDC. Part of this was predicated because this week people noticed that iMac ship times had slipped to 3 to 5 days, and usually when shipping times are slipping, that is an can be an indicator, I guess I should say, that there might be a new model coming. The iPhone 5S, he kind of felt less sure on, but what the thinking was is Apple was going to announce an 8-gigabyte model at a cheaper price, maybe to help out in emerging markets, things like that. But he was thinking Apple might not want to announce that at WWDC because it's not really that major of an announcement. Apple usually just kind of slips those things out and then the press pick it up. But if you were thinking that that was what was going to be announced hardware-wise, well, it promptly got a nope from Jim Dalrymple over at the Loop. So you can pretty much confirm that that is not happening. We're not going to see a new iMac or lower-cost iPhone 5S at WWDC. As far as what's being expected, it's pretty much known at this point. Apple's going to be showing off features in iOS 8, also the next version of Mac OS 10.10, and the big announcement, possibly a new smart home system. So some kind of connected home technology. And kind of propping up some of the rumors, Apple released the updated WWDC app last week, I think it was. And they had a bunch of mystery sessions, which was something new. So they had sessions with titles like No Comment, This One Is Sealed, Shh, I Can't Tell You or Can't Tell You Yet, and a dozen other sessions that had really cryptic titles, meaning that there's probably something they're going to show off that developers are going to have new information to sort of program against, maybe new APIs and things like that, but they're not going to let us know until they actually make an announcement. As far as that home automation announcement, I think that's kind of like the could be the one, or I kind of felt, I guess I should say, because some things changed later, as you'll hear, I kind of felt that might be the big one more thing moment. And the leak came from sources who spoke to the Financial Times, and they were saying that Apple was set to introduce a new platform for controlling in-home devices, things like lights, appliances, security systems, locks, you know, those sorts of things. So when you come home, it could detect your iPhone, turn on the lights, open your doors, maybe open your garage door, those sorts of things, that kind of integration. I would imagine thermostats and all these other things that we've seen on the marketplace. And the system was said to be also probably tying in with a new version of the Apple TV that would be released later this year. So it starts to get your mind going. That could be some interesting thing, especially Apple TV, say it had an integration with like a home security system and cameras. Someone comes to your front door, it could have motion sensors that could detect someone approaching and maybe pop up an alert on your Apple TV or on your iWatch, your phone, right? There's some really interesting things that Apple could do with this kind of technology. And Apple has reportedly been talking to connected device makers to come on board and support this new system that they were putting together. So I think this would be an amazing project. What's interesting about this leak to me is that we've heard nothing about it before this week. And to keep a secret that long, especially if Apple's been out talking to third-party companies who make different connected devices and stuff like that, that would be an amazing feat to pull off. But the idea of an iPhone or iWatch integrated with low-energy Bluetooth and Wi-Fi and NFC technology, sort of encompassing the center of an Apple-centric personal home automation system, that's really something to get excited about. And the press and the media got really, really excited about that this week. To date, I think part of the reason why is because to date, the various systems and standards for all this stuff is kind of fragmented. You have different devices and different companies making devices, and they integrate on different standards and technologies. And getting them all to kind of work together in one cohesive system is really, really tricky. And the software is kind of separate and funky, right? And you kind of have two routes you can go in this day and age right now, right? You can buy a really high-end integrated custom system that someone comes in and installs, and it costs tens of thousands of dollars. Or there's a lot of these consumer products, things like the Belkin Wemo and the Nest thermostat and these lower priced offerings. But some of those can kind of be fiddly or tinkery. You've got Insteon and I forget X10 and some of these other systems, right, that you can kind of cobble together as a home hobbyist. But it really is a lot of fiddly tinkering, and it's more for those kinds of people that like to do that sort of stuff. It's not a consumer product that you can just throw out there. So you've started to see these companies like Nest and Philips with their Hue bulbs and Belkin with the Wemo trying to bring this more to the masses. This would be Apple kind of doing that on a much larger scale. So everybody was getting hyped up and buzzed and excited about this thing until today, when GigaOhm came out with a piece saying that this announcement might not be as ambitious as a lot of us are envisioning. And unfortunately, I think what they have to say is probably more in line with what we might actually hear at WWDC. They're saying that the smart home effort is more heavily focused on getting connected devices to participate and be part of a larger, expanded, made-for-iPhone program. So it would have easy integration with apps that are already out from the developers, basically certifying that, hey, these things are going to work with your iPhone. They're going to work with the Apple ecosystem really well. You might have voice control over Bluetooth, that sort of stuff. But beyond that, that's pretty much it. So it would be smart connected device partners being able to apply that made for iPhone label on their box. So not a centralized Apple app or software layer or ecosystem. I would assume that would mean no Siri integration, which would be awesome if there were Siri APIs that control your connected devices. I'm really hoping that GigaOhm is wrong and the sort of pie in the sky dream that we all have is the bigger reality, but it may be smaller baby steps. Apple might have to start at one point and kind of move forward. I think there's a lot of people, though, that want Apple to solve this problem of so many separate systems and not really having a out-of-the-box consumer experience when it comes to home automation. So I don't know, maybe the hardware announcement will be something bigger, something more like the iWatch platform. I think if they're going to show off the HealthBook application, which some people think they might do, then they're going to have to tip their hand on the device that's actually going to be integrated and working with HealthBook. One thing that you might not see that some of us were expecting to see is the split screen feature in iOS 8. That got a lot of buzz a week or so ago. I think I told you about that on the last episode of the MacCast, that Apple had been working on a way for, in landscape mode, you could have two applications up on your iPad at once, sort of in a split screen mode. The New York Times' Brian Chen wrote on Twitter that he's been told that the split screen feature is not ready to be shown off at WWDC, so we're probably not going to see it. That doesn't mean it's not going to make its way into iOS 8. It just means that it might not be part of the keynote. And the keynote is happening on June 2nd. Apple has been busy prepping Moscone Center in San Francisco. The conference signs have been going up. The slogan is "Write the code, change the world." So we saw some pictures show up of that online this week. And what's really cool is we get to see what's going to be announced in real time. Apple is going to be streaming the keynote, which happens Monday, June 2nd at 10 a.m. Pacific time. I will try and have the MacCast IRC open. I'll put a post up on MacCast.com sometime this weekend, sometime before Monday, with the details on how to get into the chat room. We usually, a bunch of us, hang out, just chat back and forth as we watch the various live streams and just give our own little commentary and have a conversation about what we think is cool and is going on. And of course, after the event, I'll try and get a MacCast out to you so we can talk over all the great things that Apple showed off, and I'll give you my thoughts and impressions following WWDC. But as far as what is beyond WWDC, I think most of the major product announcements that we're going to see this year, Those are going to be happening in the fall. I think we can expect a lot of big things. Everybody's expecting the iPhone 6, some of the latest on that. The 4.7 and 5.5-inch models are both still being rumored. And I'm actually now beginning. I have been firmly in the camp that Apple was only going to do a 4.7-inch model. I am actually starting to get swayed just by the sheer volume of people saying that Apple's going to put out a 4.7 and then very quickly, within a month or two, follow along with a 5.5-inch model. So having two different sizes, although MacNN reports that the 5.5-inch version, some of those rumors have been kind of slowing. That could mean that maybe there's some production delays, some issues with the larger screen phone, and maybe it's being pushed off the table for 2014. Time will only tell. I think in the fall, we'll find out what Apple is actually planning on doing. I think if Apple does plan to put out two different sizes within a few months' difference, that they're going to be forced to pre-announce both versions, which could disrupt holiday sales. It could make people a little leery. Someone who might have bought the 4.7 is going to have to think hard. Do I get the 4.7 or the 5.5? That was my main rationale for them not doing it. But more and more, like I said, we keep hearing about the 5.5-inch. So I think it's real. If it is real, it's expected to carry a price premium, probably about $100 US more than the other versions of the iPhone. And both iPhone models are expected to have improved cameras as well as an updated Apple A8 processor. And an unlikely rumor hit this week in terms of the actual release date. Deutsche Telekom supposedly leaked to, I think it was their employees, or employees were telling customers in the store to expect an iPhone 6 on September 19th. That does kind of fall in line with the range we had been hearing about when in the fall we might see an iPhone release. I would expect the announcement a few weeks before that. But, you know, Apple typically doesn't kind of share that information. So it's hard to believe that they would have that kind of detail, at least this early on. So I wouldn't put a whole lot of faith in that. But September timeframe, October, September for a new iPhone seems to make a lot of sense. We're also expecting updated iPads. The big feature there most people are talking about is that all future iPads, the iPad Airs and the Minis, are going to come with Touch ID sensors. I'd also expect upgraded cameras and processors and things like that, but I'm not expecting any huge announcements on the iPad front. It's sounding like all those rumors we had been hearing about a larger screen iPad Pro, a 12-inch iPad, something like that, that's likely not going to happen until 2015. And then the other thing is this updated Apple TV. I think there definitely is an update coming for the Apple TV. As far as what it's going to include, I really don't know. I can speculate and say some of the things I'd like to see. I'd like to see Siri integration come to the Apple TV. I'd also like to see it come to macOS 10.10, by the way, and I'm hoping that is something that we'll hear about at WWDC. There have been a lot of rumors that it'll have some sort of motion control element to it. That makes sense with Apple buying PrimeSense. I really don't see controlling my television, like upping the volume and things like that with hand gestures, but I think that might more play into some sort of gaming support, app support, so it has other functionality that uses gesture-based controls. And then iMacs and MacBook Pros, I would expect some sort of update in the next few months, things like that, but I think Apple's going to just kind of quietly roll out updates, new Intel processors, those sorts of things, as they roll along. I don't expect any kind of major special event announcements for iMacs and MacBook Pros and things like that moving forward. They might do little one-offs if they have a significant update to talk about, but they'll just pull media and people in for those events, and they'll have them whenever they're ready to announce those products. There is one rumor floating around regarding future models of iMacs and MacBooks and things like that, and that is that Apple is working on ARM-based versions of those computers, that they have prototype 64-bit ARM processors in 4 and 8-core versions destined for iMacs, Mac Minis, and MacBooks. Why they might want to do that? I think Apple wants to pull in more control. They like to have control over the whole supply chain and design. They could, if they're designing their own chips and they're basing them on ARM processors, which they've had a lot of success with the A series line, they could put out lower cost and longer battery life chips, those sorts of things. So that would be good for portables and MacBook Pros, also good for pricing on the Mac Mini. And so I could see them moving at some point to a custom A-series chip design, both in desktops and laptops. Is that going to happen anytime soon? I'm not really sure. The systems are said to be running, the prototypes that they have now are said to be running a completely equivalent version of Mac OS X for the ARM platform instead of the Intel platform. That's something I also expect Apple would have in the works. They probably had for a while. If you remember, or if you've been around long enough to remember the IBM PowerPC to Intel transition, you know, Apple came out and said, hey, we've had OS X running on Intel for a while. So I think, like a lot of the stuff that Apple prototypes, they're playing around with the concept. They're seeing where they can push it, what they can do with it. And at some point, they'll evaluate and decide if it's worth moving forward with. But I don't think it's anything that's on the immediate horizon. I would expect maybe 2015, even if that. But just another rumor that's out there that I thought I'd point out. So that's all kind of stuff looking a little bit beyond WWDC. But first thing is WWDC next week. And I think there's going to be a lot of great fun stuff for us to talk about. Something that is not fun stuff is getting a message on your iPhone alerting you that it has been locked, only you didn't lock it, and the message is from a hacker demanding a ransom to get it unlocked. And that's exactly what happened to some Apple owners in Australia this week. They were finding that their devices were locked via Find My iPhone, Find My iPad, or Find My Mac, and it was hackers that were doing it, and they were demanding a ransom to actually get it unlocked. They sent them emails saying that you need to pay us $50 to $100 via PayPal to get your device unlocked. Oddly, though, the instructions included an email address that apparently wasn't tied to any PayPal account. So exactly how the criminals were planning on getting the funds, even if the victims fell for their little scheme, I have no idea. But, you know, there's no accounting for stupid criminals out there. Some of the early reports about this hack said that it was carried out via an iCloud hack, but Apple quickly responded to say no, iCloud had not been compromised. What looks like was happening is that the customer's account username and passwords were acquired some other way. Probably they were using the same usernames and passwords in another location. Maybe they were sniffed via some man-in-the-middle style attacks. No one really knows for sure. But Apple claimed that they were breached by hackers obtaining customer usernames and passwords as near as their investigating could tell. And they encouraged any of the impacted users to actually change their Apple ID password as soon as possible and avoid using the same username and password on multiple services. Always good advice, something that we've talked about in terms of security here on the MacCast. You all know that I am a big fan and user of 1Password. I have separate username and passwords for every one of my accounts. And via 1Password, yes, it's a little less convenient than having a single username and password, but much, much more secure. And the amount of inconvenience, I guess I would say, is very, very minimal with the iOS app and with the plugins they have for the various browsers on the desktop. So Firefox, Chrome, Safari, it makes it really, really easy to set up a good password scheme and a good password mechanism that's going to keep you protected against this kind of attack. If you did get hit by this attack, because I thought I saw a report that this is kind of spread into the U.S., if you did get impacted by this attack, Apple is encouraging you to contact AppleCare support or go into the Genius Bar at your local Apple retail store, and they're saying they can help you out to get the device re-unlocked. I am assuming if you have the physical device, they can verify that you're the owner, use an ID or something like that, and then they have some sort of mechanism to help get it unlocked, recognizing that you weren't the one that initiated the Find My iPhone lock. Another thing you can do on your own Apple ID if you want to keep yourself further protected in the future from this kind of attack, or just in general, I think is a good idea, is Apple does offer two-factor authentication. Again, it adds a slight layer of inconvenience, but it's going to keep your account protected because guess what? You can't log in to Find My iPhone to actually lock a device without going through the two-factor authentication. So criminals would not have had access to that physical device to actually get in there and actually lock up these accounts. Earlier in the week, we also heard reports of a different kind of iCloud attack. Apple has not responded to this one at all. It was a Dutch group who claims to have hacked the iCloud system to allow for unlocking of stolen activation-locked phones. The media was actually in some places calling this a breach of iCloud, making it seem like iCloud had again been attacked or hacked directly, but I really think it's kind of the wrong term after kind of reading the description of what was going on. It seems like to me what more of what they're doing is they figured out some sort of man-in-the-middle way where they can set up a system that acts and behaves like the iCloud server, or probably more like Apple's unlocking server, and then can trick the devices themselves into actually unlocking. So they kind of set up a pseudo server, point these locked, activation locked phones at that in some way, and enable the devices to actually be unlocked. A breach to me really implies that there was some sort of access to Apple's servers. So I don't think that's quite correct, at least based on the descriptions. I haven't delved into this really deeply. If you know otherwise, if you work in the security field and know a little bit more about this attack or hack, let me know. Send me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. But really, that just affects people who've had their iPhones stolen. The activation lock is supposed to protect you in that scenario because the thief then can't go reactivate the phone. They can't reuse it, so it makes it a less desirable target. So if they do have a way to kind of hack around that, Apple's going to need to address it, patch it up, and make sure that that can't happen in the future, because it kind of takes away that deterrent. And it's a pretty good deterrent at this point. I think we've even seen some states and some places starting to require mandatory activation locking. There were a number of reports after Apple released the feature of police and security professionals praising what Apple was doing as a really pretty good deterrent from theft of Apple devices, and expanding that out into all cell phones and smartphones and things like that would be a good thing. But couple little hacking stories in the news this week for you. And then just finishing up, I want to mention that iCloud, or iWork in the Cloud, whatever you want to call it, has received some recent updates. You can now have up to 100 people collaborating on a file in Pages, Keynote, or Numbers. Not sure exactly why you would want 100 people collaborating on a file, but if you need to do it, you can do it now. That seems like a lot of people. It seems like it'd be very, very confusing. I can't even imagine tracking changes on something like that. But also, Apple upped some of the max file sizes. You can now have a file up to 1 gigabyte, rather. That's up from 10 megabytes. And images, single image size limit has been doubled from 5 megabytes to 10 megabytes. Also, all of the applications, Pages, Keynote, Numbers got support for creating 2D interactive charts. So if you use iWork in the Cloud and haven't been on there for a couple days or something like that, you might want to check it out. There's a few updates there for you. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Want to move on to some of the feedback that I've received from you over the past week or so. I mentioned on a recent episode of the MacCast that the whole macOS 10.10 thing seemed like a lot of 10s to me. We've been kind of throwing around ideas for alternate names. I said macOS 10 cubed, I thought would be a good idea. A few people emailed in and said, you know, shouldn't we be moving to version 11 at this point? 10.9, isn't it time to move on to version 11? I think Apple came out publicly and said that they could keep with the macOS 10 branding, the macOS X branding, for a long, long time. And they've built a lot into that brand, so I think they want to stick with it. They weren't so concerned about the version numbers. We actually have each version now kind of a point release, which is really a major version. And then obviously after that, you have the incremental updates. So currently with, like, for example, Mavericks, we're on macOS 10.9.3. They're working on 10.9.4 and so on. So I think it's fairly certain at WWDC next week, we'll hear 10.10 being the version number. They're going to stick with the sort of famous names of California landmarks or places. No word on exactly what it's going to be yet, but Yosemite's been thrown around as a possible name for macOS 10.10. But addressing kind of that issue of moving to version 11, I think if we actually did that, if we said, okay, we're going to go back to the more traditional numbering scheme, you have to look at the fact that technically then we're really on or moving to the 10th version of Mac OS 10. So technically we would be really on version 20, because 10.1 should have been 11, 10.2 should have been 12, and so on and so on and so on. So if we're going to go that route, why not just go all the way to 20, and then it would be macOS XX or 10.10. I guess we're getting back into that whole too many 10s problem. but just something interesting to think about. And a few people pointed that whole moving to 11 thing out for me. That'd be some fun thing too. You can get into the whole marketing, the Spinal Tap marketing of it goes to 11. But George, who's a pilot, also suggested a scheme having more to do with what they did with the naming of the Boeing 777. I guess that's often referred to as the Boeing 777. He said, so why not macOS 1010, which I actually kind of like. That kind of rolls off the tongue. Maybe better than macOS cubed or OS 10 cubed, as you might say. I guess technically it'd be OS cubed. And I've had a debate with a few of you over, should it be macOS 10 squared because you have the X and then 10.10, or is it cubed? And Apple's always referred to it as macOS 10. So my rationale was, I see the first 10 as the X as a 10, the Roman numeral X as a 10, and then 10.10, so 3 10s being cubed. But I don't know. We could probably debate this all day. We'll find out next week what Apple's actually calling it, and it's going to be some sort of landmark. So they're really moving away from any kind of numbering in the marketing or the referencing of the OS, and more moving to the name. So we're currently on macOS 10 Mavericks. It'll be macOS 10 something else. Who knows? Another thing we spoke about on the last episode was, I had someone write in who was having trouble with album art in iTunes. And this is something that has plagued us for a long, long time. Album art in iTunes, in iPods, always seems to get at some point for all of us mixed up and jumbled, and you kind of have to go back and correct it. And from the research that I did, it seemed like one of the best fixes was to actually embed the artwork in the metadata of the audio file. And I gave a couple of mechanisms or methods on the last episode on how you could do that. So if you missed that, go back and listen to it. But one that I left out that was pointed out by Matt, he reminded me of this great resource for all things iTunes, actually, and AppleScript, using AppleScripts. And it's a site called Doug Scripts. I don't know. It's all run together, but there's only one S in there. So Doug Scripts. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And they have all these great AppleScripts that you can plug into iTunes for doing various things. Well, it turns out they actually have one for embedding artwork into your audio files, into your iTunes library, called Embed ArtScript. And what it does is it takes the downloaded files from iTunes. And as I mentioned in the last show, when you have iTunes go search for album art, it actually doesn't embed it into the audio file when it finds it. It puts it into this little special location and kind of adds a reference to it in the library. So what this script does is it goes out and it finds that associated artwork that's just referenced and then embeds it in the actual audio file. So you select the audio files that you want, and then you run the script and it will actually do the embedding for you. So that's actually a pretty good little trick. And like I said, Doug Scripts is great for all kinds of other things, for cleaning up. They've got scripts for cleaning up your album art, for finding duplicates, or cleaning up your iTunes library, for finding duplicates, all sorts of stuff. So if you were unaware of that, take a look at it. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com and a direct link to the Embed Art script. And thanks, Matt, for reminding me about that site. And then the last thing that I want to follow up on is, we've been covering over the past few episodes how to get some of your older printers and devices where the manufacturers maybe dropped support or stopped making device drivers for that printer, how to get those back up and running in the more current versions of macOS 10. And several of you wrote in to email me and say, hey, you forgot about one resource that's been around for a while that is pretty useful, and that is the whole GIMP print and Gutenprint projects. And this is an open source project. They have all kinds of drivers that are written for older devices. I actually hesitated or hadn't mentioned it on prior episodes because I knew about it. I went to go look at the site to see where they were at currently. And on the site, it says they're supporting macOS 10.2 through 10.8. So they didn't specifically mention 10.9 Mavericks, but a few of you said that you're using it with 10.9 Mavericks and it's working. Because they don't officially state that it works in 10.9, I will just say be careful. You can take a look at this if you're really desperate to get one of your older printers up and running. They have a huge extensive list of supported printers. Another thing about it is that it is Unix based, So it's a little bit more technical than just using the built-in drivers, I think. There's a little fiddling and finagling that you might have to do to get things working. It's going to be a little bit more complicated. But they do have a DMG installer, and I think it installs all of the print drivers and things like that. And you set stuff up still in Print Center. But sometimes, depending upon what you're trying to do, you might have to go in and tweak some settings. It might be a little bit more of a manual process, but it's really not too bad. And also, in newer versions of OS X, really, you should just be able to go in, and in the Print Center, you'll see the Gutenprint PPDs, the print drivers there in the drop-down list. And I think they're even labeled with like a Gutenprint or a GIMP print label on them. Apple, I think, even includes some of them out of the box as alternative drivers for maybe some of the manufacturer drivers. But the other thing you'll need to know is if you're setting up a network printer, you need to go into the IP printing setup and put in the IP address of your printer and stuff like that. That's a little bit of that more technical process of setting stuff up. But they have pretty good documentation on their website, and there's a pretty nice community surrounding it. So if you get stuck or get in trouble, a little bit of Googling, a little bit of poking around message boards and things like that can get you up and running. So that's GIMP print or Gutenprint. You can check it out. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, and it may help you salvage that old printer you've got lying in the corner that you thought was dead and gone. Now I want to tell you my latest story of woe with my MacBook Pro. I talked a little bit about this on the last member episode of the MacCast and sort of the whole process of dealing with failure. But what I wanted to mention to you here, because I think it's a good story, is how having a backup and having more specifically a clone backup really saved the day for me when my MacBook Pro's logic board decided to fail. So what happened was I had been having and struggling with some issues with the MacBook Pro for a while. It was feeling kind of sluggish. I was seeing a lot of beach balls. I did a lot of the standard stuff that we talk about in terms of repairing disk permissions, resetting the system management controller on my Mac, running disk utility and various utilities to verify that my disk drives were okay and stuff like that. And occasionally I would see these odd sort of video glitches, a little tearing here and there, some video problems when doing video playback. Didn't think too much about it, but thought, that's interesting. I wonder if I'm having some sort of deeper hardware problem. Well, I woke up one morning and my Mac was completely locked up. All I had was a black screen and a beach ball. So I went to reboot it, and all I got was the gray screen. It got completely stuck. I waited for a really long time, would not boot up. Finally, I said, you know, something more serious is going on. I'm going to boot into single user mode. And to do that, you hold down the Command and S key when you boot up your Mac. And what will happen is you'll get kind of like a Unix terminal, right? And you'll be able to see all the things loading on your Mac. And what I wanted to do was run an FSCK to just verify the disk and make sure everything was okay. Well, when I went to boot into single user mode, the screen came up, but it was DOS blue with white text. And I thought, oh, well, that's kind of odd, because normally I believe that's a black screen with white type. But hey, maybe Apple changed something in OS X Mavericks. I didn't give it too much thought, but I also kind of noticed that things looked a little interlaced. Got to the FSCK check, was able to run it. That all went fine. But when I exited that and it went back into the sort of normal boot up cycle, again, I got the gray screen completely locked up. And I thought, no big deal. I'll go into recovery mode and just reinstall the operating system, or at least run disk utility and see what I can find. So boot into recovery mode. Again, that's rebooting the Mac, holding down the Command and R key to go into your recovery disk. Well, when that started up, I ended up with a blue screen with this horrible pattern on it. It was very obvious something was very wrong. So I made my Genius Bar appointment, went down, and sure enough, they said, hey, your logic board is toast. We're going to have to send your Mac in for repair. And I went in knowing that I had full backups. I do Time Machine, Super Duper. I have, you guys know this, right? You listen to the show. I have all these backups. I went, fine, go ahead. They said, we're going to have to send it in. It's going to be 5 to 7 days, and you'll get your machine back. And they might have said 3 to 5 days. I think they said 5 to 7 days. They said it could come back sooner than that, but we really don't know. And I thought, I still have a lot of work to do. I've got to prep a MacCast. I've got to do my other work. What am I going to do? Well, luckily, I have an extra Mac lying around the house. I have a 13-inch MacBook Air, and all I had to do was pull that out and boot into my Super Duper clone, which had run the night before. So just plug it in, set up the Air, plug it in, you know, plug in the hard drive, which is a USB hard drive, and then hold down the Option key while booting, and then it'll give you the any connected drives or internal drives that have startup volumes. And I have my Super Duper set up to make a bootable clone, so I can select that drive, and boom, I was up and running. About the only trouble I had was that it was a FireWire 800 drive, and the MacBook Air only has a single Thunderbolt port. So even though I had a Thunderbolt to FireWire 800 adapter, I also use an external display, and that's hooked up on DisplayPort, and the little portable drive that I have as my Time Machine backup didn't have a second connector, so I couldn't daisy chain it together. So that option was out. Luckily, that drive also had that Super Duper drive also had a USB connector, so I just booted up in USB mode, and I was up and running. And so just a few hours after I dropped up the Mac, I was back to working. Another little problem I had was that that backup had run the night before. I have it set up to run nightly, so it had not gotten to the point where it ran for that evening. So I had a day's worth of work that was sort of lost and missing. But again, no big deal because I had my Time Machine backup. So I was just able to drill into the Time Machine, find the files. I could kind of remember what I had worked on the day before, found the files and folders that I had worked on that day, and just hand copied over the stuff that I needed. And lo and behold, I was up and running. Now, once I was up and running, I had to do a couple things. I disabled all my sort of other scheduled backups, specifically went in and disabled the Super Duper backup because that wasn't going to work because I was running off that drive, right? And Time Machine-wise, I didn't want it backing up to Time Machine. I was worried that it would sort of get out of sync with the machine that was in the shop, and I wanted it to kind of catch up when it got back. In hindsight, I think I could have probably left Time Machine running, and it would have been just fine, but I went ahead and disabled that as well. So once I did that, I thought, you know what? I really want to have some other backup because I'm kind of, you know, as you know, not paranoid, but I'm concerned about these sorts of things. And so I thought the best thing to probably do is set up Super Duper again, but with some other drive. So if you have an old drive around or you want to buy another drive in this scenario, then that might be a good thing, just keeping an extra one around. But typically what I want is a hard drive that's exactly the same size as my internal drive. So in this case, I was booted off the external drive. It was a 500 gigabyte drive. I wanted about 500 gigabytes of space. I didn't have an extra drive lying around, so I ended up using my Drobo, which had extra space, and I just went ahead and created a sparse bundle disk image. And then set up Super Duper to go from what used to be my backup drive, which I'm now booted off of and now is my boot drive, set that up to clone over to the Drobo partition. And I always set it up so that it will repair permissions and do something that's called a smart update. And what smart update does is it's going to look at the internal drive, it's going to look at the copy that's on the Super Duper backup, and then each time it's going to try and just make the two identical. So it'll only do the changes. So the first time I did have to have it clone everything over. So I manually ran a clone, got the disk image and my backup drive in the same state, and then set up a schedule, a nightly schedule, to just do the smart update. So what I have it do is each night at the end of the day, I have it run at 3 a.m. and I say, make my boot drive look exactly like the Super Duper clone. And so that's how I kept working. And so then I was able to keep on working. I didn't have to worry about my files and stuff. It was backing up every day. When they called and said, hey, your Mac's back. And by the way, it came back in 2 days. So even though they told me it was going to take 5 to 7 days, I had it back in 2 days. Amazing service from Apple under Apple Care. And I was really lucky because I was 30 days away from the end of my Apple Care. And when you get something back from service, I think they add a 90-day warranty. So I have a little bit more time now on my Apple Care should something go wrong, but hopefully, cross my fingers, nothing else is going to go wrong again. But when the system came back, then it was really just kind of reversing the process. The first thing I actually did was run my Super Duper smart update from the backup drive to the Drobo, just in case anything happened. But then all I had to do was boot up my MacBook Pro that came back from the shop, connect the drive that I was using as my boot volume, that backup drive, which had all my up-to-date files and things like that on it, and then I just ran Super Duper again. this time cloning from the drive, the backup drive that I had been using as my boot drive, back to my main Mac volume. Let that run, and once it was done, I was back to where I was again. So super duper to the rescue. This is the kind of scenario I wanted to point out and sort of how it works. So for those of you who are a little bit confused or a little bit worried about how that scenario might work, that was it. There were just a few little hiccups and caveats because the logic board was swapped out in my MacBook Pro. And also when I was working on the MacBook Air, the hardware ID changes. And I never realized how many things were sort of attached to that hardware ID. I think especially now that Apple's done the whole sandboxing thing. So I did have to reauthorize some of my accounts. I had to reauthorize or put in the serial numbers for several of my applications, things like that. And I had to do that in reverse when it came back. But beyond that, it was pretty seamless transitioning from one system to the other, and I had very little downtime, which is key for me because I rely on my Macs so heavily in doing my work. If I didn't have an extra Mac lying around, I don't know what I would have done. So that was a real handy thing to have. I do know that Apple has, if you are a professional, they have a whole program called their joint venture program, which I think is kind of like a pro version of Apple's one-to-one, where they'll come in and they'll offer you training and things like that. But as part of that service, if you buy it, and unfortunately I don't know how much it costs, you get a loaner Mac if your Mac has to go in for service. So if you're a business professional that relies on your Mac for day-to-day service and work, you might want to check that out. It's through Apple's business services program. So I think you go into your local Apple store and you talk to the business consultant there, and they can give you details on the program and tell you how much it costs. I want to say it's like $500 a year, something like that, but probably well worth it if you rely on your Mac for business. The other thing that came out of this is when my Mac came back from the shop, Apple had evaluated my RAM, which is crucial RAM. I never had any problems with it before it went in, but they came back and said they found it to be bad, and they swapped it out for the stock RAM, which was 4 gigabytes. So I have 4 gigabytes in my system right now. Luckily, Crucial is guaranteed for life, so I'm getting that replaced under their warranty program. But in the meantime, I'm finding that 4 gigabytes of RAM on macOS 10 Mavericks has not been ideal. It works, but again, I see beach balls and the system bogs down a lot. I got a lot of stuff running on my Mac from time to time, so it might be sort of my usage pattern and things like that. But I am finding it to be not as fun. But another thing quasi-related to this is I was talking to Dave Hamilton and some other people about the speed of the machine and explaining how frustrating it was. And they said, how come you haven't upgraded to SSD? And we've talked about hard drives versus SSDs, and SSDs are a really nice upgrade for an older Mac. I had always hesitated because it was relatively expensive to get an SSD. Well, it turns out SSD pricing has come way, way down. And Dave was saying, well, you can get SSDs now for about 50 cents a megabyte. And I said, what? No, that's crazy. Well, sure enough, Amazon had a Crucial M500 480 gigabyte SSD for $210 on Amazon Prime. So I ordered that thing up. I'm going to be making the plunge into upgrading my older Mac with an SSD. I haven't done it yet. It just arrived today in the mail. So I'm going to go through the process of installing it and setting it up, and I will let you all know on a future episode of the MacCast how that goes. But I fully expect it to go pretty smoothly and to have a nice upgraded machine in the future. And the thing about it was, and we've talked about this on the show, with an SSD, some of the virtual memory stuff doesn't become as much of an issue because you have those fast read and write times from your built-in drive. So if you are getting into a memory situation where in the past adding more memory would have helped, you might not notice it as much. I still doubt that the performance is one for one the same as having just more RAM available, but it is going to be a lot quicker than having to go to an older spinning drive, I'm pretty certain. So again, I'll let you know how that goes on a future episode of the MacCast, but that was kind of my my week this week in dealing with sort of logic board failures in my Mac. As you likely know, Apple issued a couple updates to iTunes 11 recently, 11.2 and then quickly 11.2.1 to deal with a little a little bug they had where the user folders for some people were going missing. Not a really good thing. I think we talked about that on the last show. But Rick and a few other people have been sending me emails right after upgrading to iTunes 11.2.1 saying that they are having a lot of problems. Specifically, iTunes just freezing up when attempting to access podcasts from the music library. And podcasts have seemed to have been a bit of a problem since this update. Apple did change a bunch of things related to podcasts. And when I received Rick's email, I went in and kind of tried the same thing. Basically, what was happening is you launch iTunes, go into the podcast tab, and then when you hit refresh podcasts, the Beach Ball would come up and it would just completely lock up. And that's exactly what happened to me when I tried this. Well, as it was going on, I decided, you know, I'll take a look at the console log and see if I can't figure out maybe what's going on under the hood here. What is the root cause of this problem? So I took a look, went into Applications Utilities Console, launched that. And what I noticed was that while iTunes was running, there were a bunch of these references to MDNS responder errors. And MDNS responder is actually related to Bonjour networking, which you wouldn't think would have anything to do with podcasts. So I was thinking, you know, maybe this isn't necessarily a podcast issue. And in looking at some of the Apple discussion boards, it seemed like people were seeing these freezes in different areas within iTunes. So thinking about, well, what would be connecting via Bonjour while I'm running iTunes, my best guess was that iTunes might be locking up because it's trying to access and sync my iOS devices wirelessly. I have iOS syncing set up for my iPhone and my iPads so that when iTunes launches, or when more specifically when a device is plugged into power, it's going to try and sync that device with iTunes, do the backup and stuff like that. So I think more what was happening was an issue with sync services, and lo and behold, I reset my sync services in iTunes and I was able to get iTunes working again. So this fix worked for me. I'm not saying it's going to work for everyone, but I thought I'd share it. To reset your sync services in iTunes, what you do is you go into the Finder and you're going to have to go under the Go menu and choose Go to Folder. And then you're going to want to go to your home so you can use the little tilde slash library. So you'll type this into the dialog, /library/application/support. You're going to go into the application support folder. If you have your library in your sidebar, or if you want to access the library directly from the Go menu, you could do it there as well. Just hold down the option key when clicking on the Go menu and then choose library, and then you're going to pick the application support folder. That might be a little bit easier, but however you get there, open up the application support folder in your library folder, and then inside there what you should see is a sync services folder, SYNC services, and you can select that, or rather click on it and drag it to the trash, and then go ahead and relaunch iTunes and see if your freezing has stopped. If it has, then you probably had an issue with your sync services folder, and then you can safely empty the trash because it will recreate that sync services folder. And this worked for me in terms of fixing up the freezing. So Rick, hopefully that will work for you as well. One thing that happened as I was sort of responding to Rick's email is Apple did also just release another update to iTunes, iTunes 11.2.2. So that could resolve any residual issues too if you've been having them. So also make sure that you've updated to the latest version of iTunes. Specifically what's in there, Apple claims that it addresses an issue where some podcast episodes might download unexpectedly, and that there's just other general bug fixes and improvements. I want to point out another thing that has been emailed to me by a number of you. I'm getting reports that there are more general problems with the podcast app or with podcasts in iTunes, specifically shows not updating. And that's always really frustrating to me being a podcaster. I don't like hearing that you guys can't get my episodes. But I had a few people point out that it's not working for them. Apple did make a lot of changes to the podcast section. I've generally found that the first step in dealing with any podcast issues is to simply just unsubscribe and resubscribe to the podcast. And that usually gets things up and running again. Now, a number of people have reported specifically having problems with my membership show. That does require the whole authentication thing. So it's behind, you know, it's behind a layer of security, a wall. You have to be a member to get in there. I use HT Access Security to make that happen. So what might be happening there is, again, you might just need to unsubscribe and resubscribe and get reprompted to enter your login information. I specifically know that it looks like in Apple's podcast app, they broke the workaround where you could enter a special URL and get access to a protected feed. That does not seem to work anymore. Luckily, it seems to still work if you manually add the podcast in iTunes on the Mac, and then because the podcast app now syncs between your Mac and your iOS devices, it will sync over the authenticated membership episode. So if you need to get reconnected there, what I would say is make sure you've subscribed in iTunes and that you've set up iCloud syncing of your podcasts from the desktop to your iOS device. And that, again, should get you back up and running. The last thing I'll mention is that several people have said they're not getting membership episodes in Downcast anymore. That's a third-party podcast app that I really, really like. Seems like there what's happening is they've done some sort of update, and it's not supporting SSL or HTTPS URLs. And I've always recommended that members use that because there's a login that happens, and you don't want that data being sent in the clear. HTTPS would protect you from that. But because that's not working right now currently in Downcast, if you need to get reconnected, what you're going to have to do is change the feed URL to be HTTP, non-secure, non-SSL, and then that should work. So give that a shot if you've been having troubles. And I guess I should point out how to unsubscribe and resubscribe in the podcast app. If you're in iOS, you go into the app, you just go to the My Podcast tab, and then tap on the show that you want to unsubscribe from and resubscribe to. And then at the top, you'll see the show name and description, the little album art. Click in that area to go to the details screen, and then tap on settings. And then you should see a little toggle that says subscribe. Just toggle that to off, and then you can toggle it back on to resubscribe. And iTunes, on the desktop, it's a similar situation. Open up iTunes, go to the podcast section of your library, click on the podcast that you want to unsubscribe from, and then in the main window, click on the little settings icon. It looks like the little cog up there at the top, and toggle the subscribed button to off, and then you can toggle it back on. And again, that'll unsubscribe and resubscribe you to the podcast. And so that should get your podcast flowing again. If it doesn't, or you continue to run into trouble, go ahead and shoot me an email. I'll see what other information I can find. But like I said, almost 90% of the time, just unsubscribing and resubscribing works for kind of fixing things. Really don't know why it gets out of sync or why it stops updating, but there you go. That's a potential solution. And then the last thing that I have for you today is actually something I've been curious about. I've been looking at the different Thunderbolt docking solutions that are on the market, specifically most recently because I ran into that problem where I had to use my MacBook Air and it only had one Thunderbolt port. And I thought it'd be really nice to have a few more connectivity options. Well, in a bout of, I guess, serendipitous timing, I recently received this message from Mark.
Hey, Adam. It's Mark here from London. I have to say, I just got delivered by Amazon today the Belkin Thunderbolt Express dock for connecting to my MacBook Air plus an Apple Thunderbolt cable. And I have to say, it is the best thing since sliced bread. In one cable coming off my Air, I have a power cable going in and the Thunderbolt cable coming out. And I have everything wired in Ethernet, my USB 3 external SSD, my FireWire 800, good old-fashioned Western Digital terabyte hard drive, my headphones, my other USB drive, my Blu-ray, Samsung Blu-ray drive, all in one port. It's just magic. If you have a MacBook Air or a Retina MacBook Pro, it's worth every penny. I even think, although I'm not an audiophile, The audio quality coming off the headphone jack on the Thunderbolt cable is way superior compared to the MacBook Air itself using an Apple Lossless file in iTunes. I just think it's pretty good. I just don't know why I didn't get it till now, because before I was using my Thunderbolt drive to either drive my Dell monitor or use my gigabit Ethernet to my AirPod Extreme. And it was like, which will I do? Will I do video data on my monitor, or will I do a guaranteed internet connection? Now I can have both. I have a wired Ethernet gigabit connection to my fiber broadband and my Dell monitor on the one port. It's just amazing. And my quality headphones, Blu-ray drive, external monitors, I'm telling you. Get it if you don't have it. Anyway, that's my rant coming from London at 1 o'clock in the morning on a bank holiday weekend, as you do on the night you receive your new toy. I haven't heard from you in a while in terms of like latest Maccast, so I hope I'm not missing anything and my connection hasn't gone wonky. Hope you're good over there in the far, far west of the United States. Take care.
I don't know why you got cut off there, Mark. I didn't do that. That's how the audio file came. But I'm assuming we were wrapping up there, and it was great to hear from you. Hopefully you hear this message, and hopefully you get this podcast, because I'm guessing you fell victim to the problem we were talking about just a second ago, where you're not getting your podcast updating. Maybe I'll follow up after this with an email to let you know that what's going on and to check your feed, because there have been some MacCasts coming out. So hopefully you haven't been... missing too many. But thank you for the review of the Belkin Thunderbolt dock. I have looked at that. I've had it in my cart, probably at Amazon. I've had it in my cart at the local big box store many, many times, and I've never pulled the trigger. And now I'm thinking more and more about it for all the same reasons that you mentioned there. You know, I've got all of these things plugged into my 2011 MacBook Pro. It has a Thunderbolt port, but I've got the Ethernet plugged in. I've got a FireWire 800 drive plugged in. I've got two USBs plugged in, and that even goes into a USB hub for more USBs. And I've got my Drobo hooked up on Thunderbolt and my monitor plugged into daisy chained into that. So it'd be nice to clean all that up and just have a single plug to plug in, make connecting and disconnecting when I need to come and go from my house a lot easier when I'm moving onto the road and going mobile and things like that. Because I don't take all these drives with me, but every time I come back, I've got to plug them all in one by one by one by one. I think the one thing that sort of held me back a little bit is all of these Thunderbolt solutions seem to only have two Thunderbolt ports. So you get one in and only one out. And I'd really like to see one with at least two Thunderbolt out, so that I have a couple different options. As I mentioned earlier, when I was having my troubles and I had to go to my MacBook Air, I can't daisy chain every hard drive that I have. So I don't have desktop drives. Typically, I have bus-powered portable drives. And so it'd be nice to have some extra Thunderbolt where I could plug in directly to that a FireWire 800 adapter. You know, luckily, this model has a FireWire 800 port on it, but most newer Macs don't. So generally, I need FireWire 800 for some of the older drives that I have. So that might be another reason why I haven't pulled the trigger. But I really like the look of the Belkin dock, and it seems to have a good complement of ports. I did want to point out a couple of the other options that are on the market, because I've gotten good recommendations for these as well. CalDigit has something called the Thunderbolt Station. Elgato makes the Thunderbolt dock, and StarTech.com, not super familiar with these guys, and I haven't heard too much about their solution, but they make the Thunderbolt laptop docking station. Not quite as sexy. It's more of a vertical thing as some of the others. I really particularly like the look of the Elgato Thunderbolt dock a little bit more than the CalDigit one. CalDigit tends to look a little more utilitarian. And the Belkin and the Elgato, I think, you know, kind of do it for me in terms of design. But in looking at the CalDigit, Elgato, and StarTech.com, they seem to have all the same complement of ports. Two Thunderbolt ports, three USB 3.0 ports, with one being on the front, which is a little bit different than the Belkin dock, the Gigabit Ethernet, an HDMI out, and then a headphone out as well as a microphone in. And I was talking to Dave Hamilton again at the Mac Observer, and he said essentially the CalDigit and the Elgato are the same guts, just in different cases from different manufacturers. And I'm guessing, looking at the StarTech one, that that may be exactly the same guts as well. So it might be that there's just sort of one Thunderbolt dock platform coming out of China or Taiwan or wherever it's made, and then different manufacturers are sort of putting their own case and power supply, a lot like we see with hard drives and some other components and things like that. Belkin does seem to be the one that is different than the others. With the Belkin solution, they give you a FireWire 800 port instead of that HDMI port. So if you need HDMI versus FireWire 800, that might be the difference for you, which is why I might end up going with the Belkin Thunderbolt dock, because I still have the two Thunderbolt ports plus FireWire. I wouldn't have to use a Thunderbolt to FireWire 800 adapter in that sense. But again, with Thunderbolt, you can chain up to five devices. You just have to remember that any monitors need to be the last device in the chain, and you got to check your devices that you're chaining up, because not all of them are going to have two Thunderbolt ports, so you might not be able to chain them together. As far as pricing goes, all of these solutions, if you look around, you seems like you can find them in the US $200 price range. So there's not much difference there. You're kind of paying the same price. Depending upon what's on sale, what's not on sale, you may be able to get a better deal. As a matter of fact, I think I saw the Belkin Thunderbolt dock on Amazon for about $153 without a Thunderbolt cable. I think it was $189.99 if you need the Thunderbolt cable to come with it. And that's like a $20 cable. So it might be better to get it without the cable and then buy one on your own, say go to Monoprice or someplace like that and get a better deal on a cable. But very much thank you for the review, Mark. I really appreciate it. And now you've got me thinking, probably going to spend a little bit more money this weekend because of your recommendation, but I think I'm going to be very happy, just like you were. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a couple of our show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disk Label, also PDF Pen for iOS, as well as Text Expander Touch and PDF Pen Scan Plus, all great applications. Love everything that Smile makes. You can check out all of their stuff, get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, if you need to sell your used gadgets, your old iPhone, your iPad, or other Apple products, check out how much money you can get for them over on gazelle.com. You can get a free offer right there up front. Take it or leave it. A really great service. I use Gazelle to resell my old devices, so when I get my new iPhone 6, I'm sure my iPhone 5S will be being passed down to my wife, and then we'll take her iPhone 5 and get a little bit of cash back for it at Gazelle. You can find more information and details and get an offer over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support, for listening, for staying subscribed, and for all the great feedback you give me. That really is what makes this show work, the whole community element. If you have a question or a comment for me, I read and answer all of my emails. You can send email to maccast@gmail.com. You can also send in audio comments there. Just attach a little audio file. You can record it in GarageBand or use the recording app on your iPhone. Tons of options available. Quick and easy. Shoot me an email and you'll likely hear yourself on the show. Also, you can call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9, and you can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. That's actually a great community. If you just have a quick question, you need some help, there are a ton of brilliant, smart people on the MacCast forum. I'm actually pretty proud of that. We've got really helpful people over there. They're great. sign up for a free account, ask your question. All kinds of different categories are set up for you. And I'd love to see you on the MacCast forum. If you'd like to follow me online between shows, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. We also have a Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you'll find us there. Pretty much MacCast on all the social media networks. I think it's TheMacCast on Flickr if you want to follow me there. I post photos and things from time to time. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.